Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. Delighted to welcome back one of my favorite posters, President and CEO of Center for American Progress, formerly Domestic Policy Council Director under Joe Biden. It's Neera Tanden. What's going on, Neera?
You know, I feel like I'm experiencing the greatest amount of joy I've had in the first 6 months. So I'm just happy to experience
that
joy.
Is it the Molly or what is it?
What's working for you? I feel like going 2 weeks on Epstein is just, you know, put a spring in my step.
Yeah, with some endorphins. Okay. But you're not concerned at all about the imminent arrest of Barack Obama?
I'm not really worried about the imminent arrest. I mean, I do think it's unfortunate we live in a kind of crazy la-la land that, like, that we could actually talk about something so insane. But my my general take is that I have never seen a politician or political leader in my lifetime act as guilty as Donald Trump has acted in the last 2 weeks. Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like it's like he's indicting himself.
So you're saying you don't think Barack Obama's like quaking in his boots right now, you know, sitting around his home, wherever he is?
No. I don't think he's quaking in his boots, in particular because Donald Trump's Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, is the one who backed up everything Barack Obama said about Russian interference with the elections. And when he talked about Russian interference in the elections, he was talking about what has been well established that they, used disinformation. And just want to say, one of the victims of that disinformation right here during the 2016 election. So I was following the news pretty closely on this.
I'm sorry, Neera. I think you are part of the hoax there. I think that when you put out your own emails and you dealt with all of the slander and all of the terrible news coverage in the New York Times as all part of an elaborate hoax working in concert with Barack Obama
to pretend like the Russians were hurting Hillary Clinton to elect Donald Trump.
To elect Donald Trump. So that you could, I don't know, do something during the transition to slow down his presidency. It doesn't even make sense if you say it. I do. Marco hasn't really gotten pressed on this.
Important. He hasn't gotten pressed. Someone should. I mean, you know, what's really sort of tragic about Marco Rubio as a human being is, you know, I remember testifying in front of Foreign Relations. It was Foreign Relations in the spring of 2016. So it was after he was out of the primary, but still like a normal Republican. And he was talking about the importance of NATO and how we needed strong alliances. And he threatened, you know, he's talking about the threat of Russia. And he has like literally eaten every actual view he's ever had in order to be Secretary of State. So I really welcome how he handles this. But, you know, you don't need to listen to me. I mean, there's plenty of video of him talking about Russia's interference with the elections.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, I don't know. Hopefully he gets pressed on that a little bit in the coming weeks. I do think, we're going to get to the CAP immigration plan. I want to kind of talk about the Project 2029 stuff in a second. But this, the thing about Marco to me this week that I just really can't get over is, thank God those men are out of Sakat, right?
Oh, but
they
do
this trade with Venezuela, this hostage deal. And there's a story out today. I don't know if you've seen this. One of the people we traded for was the perpetrator of a triple murder in Madrid. Mm-hmm. He killed people with an axe, I guess. Dahoud Hanid Ortiz. And it's like Marco just gives this huge geopolitical win to Maduro, to the communist dictator that he proposes to hate. And now Maduro gets to go around saying, I saved these men from the capitalist white devil. and be accurate about it, kind of. And we sent the people that were fleeing communism to like a concentration camp. And it's all Marco. I feel like he almost gets kind of a pass on this because people focus on, you know, Trump and the Stephen Miller. But it was Marco's the Secretary of State. It was Marco that orchestrated this whole thing where we send the people to El Salvador. They were fleeing communism just like his parents did. And then now he gives this huge win to Maduro. It's wild.
I mean, that is a horrible story. But, you know, let's just step back. These people were fleeing Venezuela. And now they are being, and why were they fleeing Venezuela? Many of them were opponents of the Maduro regime. You know, in a normal world, Republicans would have supported opponents of the regime, a Marxist regime, right? So, like, that's what's also really crazy about this whole immigration slash human cruelty regime, right? You have people in any other time who are fleeing a communist regime coming to the United States to make a better life for themselves. You know, we did take a lot of Venezuelans, totally accept that. But they were people who are, you know, basically most of these people were political opponents of a Marxist administration. We send them to an El Salvadoran gulag. Our courts say that's like reprehensible. So instead of pulling these people back into the United States because they think this would be some kind of political loser, right, to acknowledge that their plan was wrong, they have sent the opponents of the regime back to Venezuela, right? So, I mean, if you actually think about it, it gives a lie to like 50, 60 years of Republican foreign policy about how we have to be a beacon against communism and Marxism. And it's just like, it's just another core Republican tenet set aside for MAGA white nationalism that doesn't want brown people here. So, I mean, that's what I think. I mean, I'd love Marco Rubio to ask, like, why he thinks it's okay. I mean, would he be okay if we sent Cubans back to Cuba? No, that would be terrible. Maybe, because they're opponents of the regime. I mean, who knows now? But, you know, usually, like, you want to ensure that people who leave dictatorships and who are actually fleeing to democratic capitalist countries, you know, that has helped us geopolitically in the past.
Yeah. I mean, Marco kind of positions his own story as having fled communism, even though technically I think his parents fled like the pre-communist fascists in Cuba. But either way, just a total gift to Maduro in exchange, apparently, for an axe murderer. Before we get into the, you know, more challenging questions, let's just kind of roll around in the Epstein stuff for a little bit and just in this fucking bed that they've made for themselves.
Yeah, live by the sword, die by the sword, my friend. It is like, you know, like it is the most like karma experience. Like it's so...
Really is. So the house is shutting down until September, I guess. Ann Coulter, famous lib, tweeted, "This totally conveys innocence," with a screenshot of the Mike Johnson plan to shut down the house. I guess on the one hand, I just kind of riff on what it says that they like that they've completely, I guess, given up on governing because they are covering up this Epstein situation. But also, I mean, I guess about the Democratic strategy and how that's it feels like they finally found their sea legs a little bit on using the limited power they have to pressure these guys.
Yeah, I mean, let's just be clear. What's happening here is because there was a bipartisan but heavily Democratic discharge petition that's, you know, also pressuring the Rules Committee because, you know, Democrats and some Republicans, but mostly Democrats, are talking about the Epstein case. And let's just be reminded what the Epstein case is about. The Epstein case is about Jeffrey Epstein, who is a known sex trafficker. And because essentially people are asking for the files to be released, Republicans do not want to take a vote on the release of the files. Because, I mean, let's just also say, let's say you're a Republican. Like, why are they trying to avoid this vote so much, right? Like, let's just game this out. Let's say you're a Republican House member and you vote no on releasing the files, right? Like we could get a vote where a handful, most likely outcome here on a discharge petition is a handful of Republicans join Democrats in getting a discharge petition and getting a push for release of the files. Somehow the files come out after this discharge petition, and then you have voted no, which is what most of the Republican Party will do because Donald Trump will demand that. And then terrible things come out about Donald Trump. So you have now just opposed that. So I think this is a protection of his own members. And I think they're hoping that people will just forget this in the next 5 weeks, which is odd since they haven't forgotten it in 6 years since the man died. But, of course, who knows? I think at this point, you know, when people are in power in a moment like this, you're in a scandal, people are living day to day. I think Mike Johnson is just like, I need to get out of town. So to me, this whole effort is just confirmation about the fear of what's in these files, because no one would get the headlines of closing down the House, which, of course, I cannot remember this ever happening. I've lived through some scandals, by the way. Of course, yeah. I worked for Bill Clinton in the last couple of years there. Lived through some scandals myself. I've never seen the House just shut down business, the Senate just shut down business, either House shut down business in order to avoid votes on a scandal. So, I mean, I just think this confirmation to not just, you know, tin hat foil wearing people, but to just normal people that the entire Republican Party is in cahoots to close these files down.
Yeah. And when this all started, I think Hakeem Jeffries' point was well taken, which was kind of like they're either covering up something about Trump in these documents, or, you know, they're embarrassed because they're lying the whole time about their, you know, being whatever Epstein files at all. It's not even really an either or for me anymore. Like, it's pretty clear they're covering up something that for trying, you know, you have the Durbin letter to Kash Patel that's like, supposedly, according, and I assume you got this information from people inside the Justice Department, they had FBI officials reviewing these documents and flagging mentions of Trump.
Yeah.
So to me, that signals that they have at least some mentions of Donald Trump in the files.
I mean, not only that, but this is, again, yesterday they announced, just a reminder, it's the president's personal attorney. Is the deputy attorney general. Also weird, just to say out loud.
Yeah.
Isn't it stupid? But it's also like, let's just think about that. Isn't that suspicious at this point that he put his personal lawyer as
personal
minder
criminal
of the
attorney,
entire,
too.
His not personal just, criminal attorney
not
as
like,
minder
not
of
like
the
like his campaign attorney or whatever, like his criminal attorney.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I mean, for those of us who want to go into the Wayback Machine of the Clinton era, it's like putting David Kendall, Bill Clinton's personal attorney, like as deputy to Janet Reno. I think people would have found that really weird. Yeah. So, okay, I mean, Trump makes everything weird, so like, it just normalizes, but just now in the context of all of this, I think it looks really weird. But so his personal criminal attorney, who is the deputy AG, announces yesterday that he's going to interview Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell, right? So just a reminder, they put out a memo 2 weeks ago saying there's no there to this. There's no client list. There's nothing to this scandal. And it's clear that they never even talked to Ghislaine Maxwell in order to determine the backing of that memo. So, like, this is what the problem is in a scandal, is it's impossible to think 10 steps ahead. And I think, you know, you are absolutely right. At the beginning of the scandal, it was like, well, I mean, Pam Bondi was telling the truth. She's telling the truth now, or she's telling the truth in February, but she couldn't be telling the truth both times. Now, during all of that, I was like, of course, why is Pam Bondi going through any of this unless someone is ordering her to? But now I think it feels pretty certain because, of course, you could just throw Pam Bondi under the bus with this level of scandal, right? You don't have to fire her. You could just say she was an idiot. She screwed this whole thing up. She can apologize. But they're not doing that. He's defending Pam Bondi. You know, it's not like he's known for loyalty. He's defending Pam Bondi.
Because she's doing what he wants.
Yes, because basically, like, what's the most obvious answer here? They're all covering up Donald Trump in the files. Like, that just seems like so. And, like, you would not have the House just adjourn. And all these Republicans have to answer the question if it was really just an issue of Pam Bondi looking like a jerk. Like, nobody would do that. Hence the spring in my step. I mean, I shouldn't, I'm not trying to be a total jerk, but it's been a rough 6 months. We need to take.
You got to take your wins where you can get them.
You got to just take the joys where you have them.
You know, I wish I could grow a beard. I did not shave throughout the entirety of my European vacation. Came home, was thinking, okay, maybe I can try out a new look. Maybe I can do the Pete Buttigieg, you know, come back with a beard for everybody. But yeah, I don't know. The good Lord doesn't want me to have a beard. I still couldn't do it. I have huge, huge gaps all over my face where no hair emerges. And as such, I need a reliable grooming tool to make sure I'm looking fresh for y'all. And we've been turning to our new sponsor at Harry's. Harry's is your trusted partner for making a good first impression. And right now you can get a $10 trial set for just $8 plus a free gift at harrys.com/thebulwark, an exclusive offer for our listeners. I'm a traditional razor guy, you know, like a heavy razor, the blades, natural blades. I don't fucking know the terms. Am I supposed to know the terms? All I'm supposed to know is that it works well. I don't like the electric thing. You know, I want a nice, real shave. The Harry's razor does the job perfectly. German engineered blades. You know the Germans do things well. German engineered blades made in their own factory that stay sharp longer. Customizable delivery option for scheduled refills for as low as $2, half what you pay for other big brands. And you can get that 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, and travel cover for just $8 plus a free gift at harrys.com/thebulwark. Show everyone you mean business. Get Harry's. Normally their trial set is $10, but right now you can get it for $8 plus a free gift at harrys.com/thebulwark. That's our exclusive link, harrys.com/thebulwark, for an $8 trial set and a free gift. As you mentioned, you've been on the incoming side of some select committees and some oversight committees and subpoenas and all that. So thinking about that, I mean, if the Democrats take back the House, we'll get to the politics of this in a little bit. Like, what are the tools, I guess, available for them both right now, whether in the minority and then prospectively next year, if they were to take the majority back as far as Epstein is concerned?
Yeah, right now, I mean, I think the most important tool they have is the fact that there is such bipartisan outrage about this stance and the lack of transparency that Republicans are feeling more pressure on this. I mean, it is a little ironic that they feel more pressure on Jeffrey Epstein than like cutting health care for millions of people. That is like kind of a weird thing.
Letting the poorest children in the world die. Having masked agents grab people off the street and send them to foreign gulags. Yeah, sure. There are other things that you would think they'd feel pressure on, but okay. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, I do think that's a like unfortunate thing about their side, but whatever. So, you know, that is obviously creating a lot of pressure when you have Josh Hawley, Tim Burchett, others saying, you know, just get all the material out there, even though they all know Donald Trump does not want to get all the material out there. So I think their number one tool, which they are using, is the discharge petition. In the Rules Committee, there are not limits on amendments. So the threat of the amendments in the Rules Committee is really what is getting everyone scared to avoid a rule. So rules are necessary for, you know, bills that are not overwhelmingly supported. So any bill that has like you would get 55 or 60% of Congress to vote for. So that's what's making them close down. Essentially, they don't want to face a vote in the Rules Committee. So I think the Democrats have been very strong. And, you know, I will say, you know, it does feel like they are bringing a gun to a gunfight. You know, they are saying out loud, release the files if Donald Trump has nothing to hide. You know, I know that it seems, you know, it's like a little weird for members. Maybe they feel uncomfortable saying like the strongest accusation here. But we have to make clear what we are fighting for, and that is transparency about a case in which a man victimized lots and lots of girls and women. And it is a case where, you know, it was a bunch of powerful men who seemed to be victimizing people. Jeffrey Epstein got a sweetheart deal on his first interactions with law enforcement, in part, I think, really because he was so powerful and had a lot of friends. And just as a reminder, the prosecutor who gave him that sweetheart deal was in Donald Trump's cabinet as his first labor secretary. So in his first term, he had to resign because of all the interactions with Epstein. So you know, I mean, I just think like this is an area where you just have to prosecute the case aggressively. And it is having an impact. I mean, the fact that Democrats are carrying this has made the Republicans, you know, go into kind of free fall. But I will also say an important thing is if they take power next year, you know, they should commit to issuing subpoenas to release the files.
Yeah, there should be a Benghazi style committee.
Absolutely.
This,
right? Absolutely. Yeah. A giant public committee airing everything that happened with these files. And also, they should be going through the actions around this cover up over the last, or, you know, seeming cover up over the last, you know, basically a couple of weeks.
Subpoena the people that were reviewing these documents.
Yes.
Like, if that's true.
Subpoena
like,
Pam
yeah,
Bondi
like,
to come forward. Yeah, you know, right. I mean, look, yeah. Republicans could have Pam Bondi testify this week. They are not doing that. Why? Because they're scared what she will say.
Okay. I have one loyal listener who'll be upset at me if I don't ask you this legit question, which is, if Trump is in these files as much as it seems like he is, why didn't the Biden administration do anything about this? An administration you were in. What do you think about that?
Yeah. So this is what I'd say to this. I mean, I get this all the time. So I didn't think
you were
like
not
going to
be expecting the question, but it is a question that merits
no,
asking.
It's like literally.
Like, it's like
anytime I say anything on Epstein, they're like, why didn't Joe Biden release the files? And this is what I'd say. Have you met Merrick Garland?
And we're blaming Merrick Garland. Okay, great.
I mean, I'm just saying, first of all, I mean, legitimately, the Joe Biden White House had nothing to do with enforcement on any topic. If anything, because of the abuses of the Trump administration, the White House, you know, didn't engage in any particular enforcement matter. We barely did engage in policy with the Department of Justice. They were so arm's length to us. So, I mean, I can attest to that from my experience as DPC, domestic policy chair. We in the White House had no idea. So I can't really tell you why Merrick Garland didn't do it. I would say that he was hypersensitive about any perceptions of unfairness to a point where I think, you know, I'm not sure justice was always even done. And I can imagine he thought, you know, after he's doing January 6th and all the conservative blowback on that, maybe he wouldn't even look into Ghislaine Maxwell, but someone should ask him because Maxwell and Epstein. But
he could have been nice and bipartisan and nabbed Bill Clinton and Donald Trump. Would have been okay with me.
Yeah, exactly. I wish they did. I mean, I wish he had looked into it. Yeah. I mean, I kind of think this was an issue of the far right that was really pushing it with some kind of crazy allegations, and it would have been better. I mean, like, let's just remember Donald Trump was president when Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide. It's not like he committed suicide in the Clinton White House or something, in the Clinton administration. So, you know,
yeah, Bill Barr was attorney general when he committed suicide, and Bill Barr's dad gave him his first job, longtime friend of the Barr family. So take that for what you will. I don't
You know, like when you see
missing,
that
there's
meme.
Some missing minutes in the camera. That's all I know.
I know. It's
I'm
exactly.
Just telling you what
I mean,
know.
Also, what's weird is, you know, according to Wired, there are now 3 minutes missing. Like, does that not feel weird? Does that feel like a glitch? 3 minutes missing in the camera? I don't know. It's like, I just think it's
this
like.
This takes me to my Pete Buttigieg question back to you, though, thinking about Merrick Garland, which was if you had a time machine, if you had a DeLorean, you could go back to the beginning of the Biden administration and you could sit down. I mean, Joe doesn't drink, but you could sit down with the former president and you're in the Oval Office and he's just like, Neera, you have this wisdom having come from the future. Tell me one thing I should do different. Is Merrick Garland the thing you do different or something else?
I mean, I think Merrick Garland. Yeah, I mean, Merrick Garland is a very nice man and has a lot of wisdom on a lot of topics, but I just think was not like living in the world that we are in today. You know, he just, I mean, I think it's a tragedy he moved on the special prosecutor around January 6th. So it took him so long to do that, that it just became impossible to have real accountability. And I think that's, you know, we're kind of living with the results and that's a tragedy. And I think he thought, and, you know, I'd say, look, I think a real challenge is that in the Biden administration, there was this whole theory of, like, we just need to restore institutions and order. And I think there was a broad misunderstanding that politics has fundamentally changed. I don't think you should have a Department of Justice that's weaponized like the current one. But I also think, you know, like you have to think about time horizons on accountability and go a little bit faster than rather go so slow.
If you're like me and wish you had listened to your dorkiest internet friend and had bought Ethereum or NVIDIA before they boomed, well, there are other ways to break our generational cycle and secure you and your family's future. One way is through life insurance at SelectQuote.com. If you're new to life insurance, you're not alone. Thankfully, I've found SelectQuote. For over 40 years, SelectQuote has helped more than 2 million Americans understand their options and get the coverage they need. Over $700 billion in coverage and counting. SelectQuote takes the guesswork out of finding the right life insurance policy. You don't have to sort through dozens of confusing options on your own. Instead, one of their licensed agents will find the right policy at the right price for you. Comparing plans from trusted, top-rated insurance companies to find a policy that fits your health, your lifestyle, and your budget. They work for you for free. You'll be covered faster than you think. SelectQuote works with providers who offer same-day coverage up to $2 million with no medical exam required. SelectQuote makes life insurance simple, even if this is your first time thinking about it. Head to SelectQuote.com and a licensed insurance agent will call you right back with the right policy for your life and your budget. Life insurance is never cheaper than it is today. Get the right life insurance for you for less and save more than 50% at SelectQuote.com/Bulwark. Save more than 50% on term life insurance at SelectQuote.com/Bulwark today to get started. That's SelectQuote.com/Bulwark. All right. That takes us to the current day. Whether we've learned any of those lessons, let's talk a little bit about some democracy concerns. The redistricting stuff is out there. Obviously, Texas talking about redistricting. They think that they can potentially get 5 more seats out of there. I mean, I looked at that map. It's a preposterous map that would go from like Houston to Amarillo or something. There'd be a district. So I don't know if they're really going to be able to get 5 out of there. But you know, there's some discussions about what the Democrats can do, should do. J.B. Pritzker in Illinois said earlier this week, we ought to play by the rules, but counterbalance might be necessary. Is that the right way to think about it? Is counterbalance the right way to think about it? Or should California and Illinois just start doing redistricting right now?
I mean, I think it's hard to redistrict a little bit more out of Illinois, since I don't really think they have many Republicans. They have very few seats there, but it's really...
We can't squeeze 2 more out of there? We can't squeeze 2 more out of there?
My overall take here is that, you know, democracy is really on the line. Let's just be clear what's happening. Donald Trump has called up the governor of Texas and said, I want you to squeeze 5 more seats, because he thinks if he has the playing field he has today, which is not even really level, because North Carolina already did a post-decennial redistrict and gain 3 seats, which, again,
North Carolina
kind of...
map is absurd.
That map is absurd. And just to say, if they hadn't done those 3 seats, we could be like Speaker Jeffries, one seat away from that, or like right there any moment. So, you know, like, I think the lesson, basically what Trump
maybe
wants to do...
Maybe had fewer Democrats died. And yes. North Carolina not redistricted. Maybe we'd have Speaker Jeffries.
I'm for both of those things.
Okay. alive Democrats.
Alive Democrats.
Fair mats in North
Carolina. Right. People not running who are that old. So I'd say, you know, if we just recognize what's going on, Trump thinks he's going to lose with the maps that we have. He's going to lose the House with the maps that he has. He's probably worried about accountability for Jeffrey Epstein and any other accountability. And so that's why he is asking to change the rules. And, you know, we had Beto O'Rourke at the Center for American Progress. And, you know, he talked about this issue specifically. And, you know, I think there's an incredibly persuasive case to make that the actual way to stop this race to the bottom, right? I mean, the fundamental problem we have is Republicans are willing to squeeze out more seats, and Democrats, you know, blue states have kind of traditionally done these commissions. So what does that create? It's an imbalance where Republicans can put power above process or due process or norms or right, like the right thing to do or morality, and just gain power. And I think, unfortunately, we live in a world right at the moment where you have to fight fire with fire. The only thing we can do to stop a Texas from going through an ugly redistricting is a threat of blue states doing the same. And if they go and proceed, you know, blue states are going to have to do that. And it will be hard in California. But I mean, I think they should undertake the process of, you know, like relooking at their constitutional, their proposition on their commissions, because that's, you know, California is going to be an important counter to what happens in Texas.
Are there other states besides California that could do that? I know there's some talk in Wisconsin, but they're getting stymied by the state Supreme Court. Are there other places that could potentially?
New York had a map. They went through an interaction with their courts. Maryland has potential of map. They've had some challenges with their courts. I do think there'll be a question of how courts look at these redistricts, even in blue states, if they are looking at Texas kind of redistricting in the middle to do it. So, you know, I like, unfortunately, we live in a world that some of us argued, like, in a decade ago that maybe blue states shouldn't go through these commission processes because Republican states could do things like this. And I remember really, you know, good government people saying, no, we have to role model. But this is exactly why you need national legislation that prohibits gerrymandering, because otherwise you do get this asymmetry. Like, blue states go through these independent commissions. Like, that's the problem in California. They have an independent commission. And red states just, like, you know, almost illegally draw lines that now there's, like, essential lawlessness around because the Supreme Court has, like, exited this area. And so that is, like, the fundamental, you know, I mean, we just live in a world where if one party is going to put power above everything else, the only way to address that is really strong countermeasures.
I have another strategic question for you about Texas. It's maybe a little touchy, and so I want to give a long preamble to it to be nice to people, because you had Beto at CAP yesterday. I love Beto. It seems like he's thinking about running. I don't know if he's going to. I like Colin Allred a lot, who's running for Senate in Texas. This guy James Tallarico, I don't know him, but he seems like a good person, and his Joe Rogan interview is nice. You look at Iowa, Zach Walls is running, great guy. All these people seem like good people. They also all seem like different flavors of vanilla Democrat to me. And the Democrats, like, really need to win Texas or Iowa if they ever want to take back the Senate again. And so, I don't know, you're kind of more in these meetings than me. I say it about myself, like, I like me as well, but I wouldn't pitch me as the solution for winning back a Louisiana Senate seat from Bill Cassidy. I don't think I'd be the strongest candidate to put up for that. You know, a gay guy, I don't think is probably going to win Louisiana, even as a former Republican. So you got to be kind of hard-headed about this stuff. Is there any effort to, like, try to recruit people in these states, like, that, you know, have a little bit of independence from the Democratic brand? Are those conversations happening? Are there worries about this? Or is everybody just going to kind of get on board with the horses that we got in these races?
You know, I think the thing for all of us to think about is, how do we have policies and ideas that can actually win in purple to red states? So, you know, I think this is, like, the big, you know, we had this big debate. Should we, there are lots of Democrats who are like, you should recruit, like, union members who are independents in a bunch of these states.
Sure. Dan Osborne style.
And look, John Bel Edwards won the governorship of Louisiana, and he is, you know, he is pro-life. He's anti-choice, but he did a Medicaid expansion. Or Andy did a Medicaid expansion, you know what I mean? And, like, did a lot of good in that state, right? So I think we have to do really two things. One is, we have to give grace to people who have different positions than other people in states that they are running in. But I also think we need a fundamental rethink of how we have policies and ideas that can appeal to people in a place like Iowa, as well as a place like Illinois or California. And I will say, you know, this is maybe to get to it. You know, this is one of the ideas behind our immigration plan. We know Center for American Progress put forward an immigration plan that secures the border. It ends the abuse of the asylum system. We do believe there was misuse and abuse of the asylum system over the last four years, longer actually, since 2017. Started really 2015, 2016, grew in 2017. The smugglers figured out the system back over like almost a decade ago. So we fixed those parts and also believe we should expand legal immigration. And I think and provide a path to citizenship for people who've been here 10 years or longer. And I think that plan, you know, that plan is broadly supported in the country. It's as 60-70% and can be a plan that you could talk about in Iowa and California. And that is what I think actually the party needs to do. It has to have ideas. I mean, you can ask candidates to go into states and run against the party, right? Like, or you can expand the tent of the party so that it's actually welcoming of ideas that are a little bit more broadly expansive than where we have been. And my view is that, you know, it's important to offer ideas out there that a person running in Iowa doesn't have to run away from, but could actually strongly embrace and say this is kind of a mainstream view. Because, you know, the truth is we live in a hyper-polarized world and you can have a great candidate, but if, you know, basically they have to say, I'm going to vote, you know, I'm going to fight the party, then if you really want to fight the party, you'll just go with the Republicans. So like, I kind of think you have to actually engage in a broader effort to kind of recenter ideas. And the party and our immigration plan is one step in doing that. You know, we also have to have ideas that excite our base and other things. You know, we're not like fighting with the base every day, but we're trying to create ideas that kind of can unite people to get to a better, higher ground and not create those conflicts. And also, I, you know, just to say one last word, and in Iowa and other places, I think if you have a plan, if a Democrat, even in Iowa, has a plan where they can, you know, talk about a secure border, it allows them to go on offense against Republicans who right now are like eliminating due process or ignoring due process to pick people off the streets who have been here 10, 20 years, eliminate the legal status people have so you can deport them. I mean, people have been here 30 years, 25 years, 30 years under legal status from temporary protected status because they were fleeing a communist regime. They got that status. This administration's policies are so extreme, they're getting rid of that status so they can deport them to countries they don't even know. So I think Democrats should be able to go on offense on these issues, but they probably feel more secure if they have a big plan that does that.
I mean, I think that you're right, exactly, on the immigration stuff. I guess I would ask, I mean, if there are any other of those types of policies you want to talk about like what might make sense for the Democrats in a proactive policy platform. But also just think about it in the context of, I mean, I'm with you. I mean, I'm a moderate squish. So let's put out a policy platform that's going to appeal to 60% of the country. That's probably going to appeal to me more. But that's not really what MAGA did, right? Like they put out their Project 2025 plan that had a lot of deeply unpopular things in it, but they were able to kind of offset it because Trump like did run against the party, not against the Trump party, but against the Bush party, basically, on like wars and entitlements, essentially. And so I don't know, is there not room to kind of do both, right? Like have a can't, you know, have a broader, more appealing agenda, but also run against whatever people perceive to be some unpopular parts of the party over the last decade.
Yeah, but you know, you could embrace our immigration plan and be a critic of, you know, what happened in the last administration, right? Like that's sure. That's a way to also think about it. Trump did attack, you know, where I think lots of people thought the George Bush administration had gone wrong, which is the Iraq War was a disaster, and he was willing to say that. So, you know, I mean, future Democrats could say, maybe we handled this problem badly. That's fine. And like, I think that's like important and good. I think it's like, do you think people want candor? And it's important to be honest about those things. I guess I'd say, you know, when it comes to Project 2025, I think we should be really clear. Like, the Trump campaign was lying, but did say that Project 2025 wasn't their agenda. And so, you know, I do think there's an important role for people to do actually a version of Project 2025, which was go agency by agency. And our version, we would, and we will do this at the Center for American Progress, you know, go agency and aid by agency and actually think about how we can rebuild them to actually meet people's needs, which it's kind of the inverse of what Project 2025 did, but it is like a similar sure. kind of detailed plan. Over the next year, you know, we're going to be putting out ideas on a whole slew of issues, you know, and I think, again, we think of these as issues that can attract a broad majority, but they won't necessarily always be like squishy bit moderate or whatever. You know, I think there's really bold ideas on housing that we can do that get to supply, but also take other steps. We will be offering ideas on, you know, I think how we ensure public safety in the country. Want to just remind everyone that working class people experience crime at a much higher level than, you know, college educated folks. And sometimes if we feel impervious to crime, we can communicate that it's really not that big a deal. And I think that's a problem. So, but, you know, I also think it's wrong that Republicans kind of, and Trump does this every day, he creates a straw man between improving public safety and caring about people's civil rights. And we don't have to choose. We can actually lower crime and maintain due process rights and respects for people. So, and I think, in my view, I think we have to answer the mail across the board. Like, I think a big challenge is sometimes we don't engage in these ideas, these debates. We just, like, retract. And I think that is a huge problem.
So you're not worried about the recruitment like me? We got into policy. You're not worried about the... You don't feel like, I mean, it's okay. This is a fine position to have. I don't think there's a clear answer, right? Like, I don't, you know, going out and recruiting 8 Dan Osbornes, I don't know. Like, that might not work, but it's different. It's something different. And the Democrats haven't won in these states in a while, in the Florida, Texas, Ohio, Iowa type states. And so I'm kind of open to different ideas. But where are you at on kind of the recruitment side?
I mean, I guess my take is I'm open to different ideas, too. And I actually think, honestly, I mean, like, if independents want to run, I think that then it, like, puts pressure on Democratic candidates to actually prove that they can win.
I think
my take in the Trump era is we should do whatever it takes to beat back the assault on democracy. And if that's a Dan Osborne in a state or others. But, you know, I also think let's give people some chance to show that they can get a strong majority, you know, that they can actually win.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Thinking of different ideas, you know, I have to ask you about Zohran mania. You haven't always been the darling of the Zohran wing of the party, I wouldn't say, based on my monitoring of your Twitter mentions.
I'm big tent everywhere.
You're big tent. So you're cool. I don't want to push you. What were your observations about the Zohran campaign? What do you think about
him? My basic take is, like, we should learn lessons where we can get them, right? He communicates in a great way. He's very candid. I do think, like, the lesson, you know, one of the things I draw from his videos, which I find very entertaining, honestly, is that he is taking on, like, elephants in the room. He talks about, you know, basically the New York Post out to get him. He jokes about it. He's funny. I think he does understand politics is also a little bit about entertainment. He's gotten a lot of young people to support him. I mean, I have some, you know, I do think he should condemn just clearly globalized intifada as an anti-Semitic term. And so, you know, but it does sound like he's moving in some direction there. To me, it's not that complicated to just say it's like anti-Semitic. It seems like an easy sentence. But, you know, I think we should be candid that we are kind of in a shitstorm, honestly. And we have to learn lessons of victory wherever we can get them. I also think New York City is a big, complicated place, and people in our party, or in the Democratic Party, I shouldn't say our party, where I'm a 501c3, but in the Democratic Party, on the broad center left, should recognize New York has elected Republicans multiple times in the last couple of decades. So I think, you know, if I were advising the Mamdani campaign, I would say, like, you also have to demonstrate. There's a lot of talk about, you know, why aren't Democratic leaders embracing him? I could say they're not embracing him because there are some, like, deep concerns about some of his stances. But he should also recognize he has to reach out, not just in talking to people, but in some of his policies if he wants to have a broad coalition to defeat his opponents in the election, some of whom, you know, I think Cuomo did not run a good campaign. In fact, it was kind of a horrifying campaign in that he didn't actually campaign. But, you know, he is also, like, I think he's a tougher candidate than some people think in a general election in New York.
I've become anti-Zoran a little bit, to steal a phrase from my old friends that are on the National Review, who are anti-Trump. Yeah. I'm anti-Zoran. And I think it's kind of weird that some of the Democrats haven't embraced. Honestly, you can say, I think he has some policies I don't agree with, but he's clearly better than, you know, Eric Adams. I don't know. I mean, you don't see a lot of Republicans saying, like formally saying, I refuse to endorse Marjorie Taylor Greene. I don't know. Maybe they should. I guess I'm not sure. What do you think? It's a little strange that people are not just like, you can say I prefer him with reservations, right? I don't know.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I guess I'd say, I think honestly what's happening, you're right. It is just a mayor's race. And, you know, because it's New York City, everyone thinks America is fixated on it. But I also think, I think there's a delicate dance probably going on behind the scenes of, you know, where does he move on some issues? Where do leaders move on some issues? And where are actual voters, you know? So my take is this is probably not the end of the story. It's probably the beginning of it where it is. And, you know, we're not like Democrats aren't like Republicans. You know, most of the time, that's a good thing. You know, we aren't like just fall in line with everybody, et cetera.
Yeah, I agree with that. I like the question was out and halfway through the question, I was like, wait a minute. I want Republicans to not endorse Marjorie Taylor Greene. What am I doing? Why am I modeling that? Like, that's the good behavior.
Like, are you like, we're supposed to like, and also you're making, I'm not saying Mamdani's like Marjorie Taylor Greene. I just want to say you said
I'm comparing him to Marjorie Taylor Greene. That was you. Well, I mean, they both have the same position on Israel, I guess. So they have that one thing in common. Okay, we're going to move on before I get in trouble.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Speaking of the delicate dance behind the scenes, Chris Murphy said something to me yesterday. Now that I'm a media man, I'm a podcaster, I'm like out of, I don't go to the conferences with the donors and stuff anymore. That's just not my world. It used to be my world. You're still in that world. He was saying that he's still pretty concerned that like Democratic donors are going to sit on the sidelines out of a combination of fear of retribution from Trump and a feeling of like, it's a fait accompli. The midterms are always good for that party. Why should I put myself on the line? Are you worried about that? Are you seeing that at all in your kind of convos?
I mean, I think an asymmetric asset that Trump has and is definitely using is that he uses fear to intimidate people. So I think there are a range of institutions, and not just donors, philanthropy, like the business sector, who's, you know, would have been in any normal world standing up a lot more to the insanity that we're seeing. And there are actually a whole range of people who I think are just basically intimidated into not engaging in the fight. And I find that very frustrating as a person who's engaged in the fight every day and just, you know, can't, like, I'm definitely under right-wing attack, but like, I want to tell my grandkids that I did everything I could in this moment to save the country. And I definitely think that's what's at stake. So I feel like people, the more outrageous Trump has become and the less popular he has become. And so it is important to remember it's not like, you know, I think there's a discourse in Democratic politics a lot or in like the broad center left, like, you know, polling doesn't actually matter. It doesn't matter if people go into the streets. He's impervious to everything, but it really does matter. It is signaling to other people that you can stand up against him. And when other countries that have gone through authoritarian threats like this, Orban, others, when the opposition just goes to sleep because it's so ugly, that is when democracy fails. So I do think like donors are kind of getting, a lot of people are kind of coming into the fight. There's obviously a need for a lot more, but we should also recognize that there is a kind of tremendous amount of fear. I mean, I've never had people raise to me issues like, could the administration come after me? And they are now. And that is a deep concern. But it's also, it's important to remind people every day, he is a deeply unpopular president. He is the most unpopular president at this time. His actions on things that are strengths like immigration are unpopular with the country. His positions are unpopular. The majority is against him.
I love that you're in the fight. That's what I appreciate about you. Is there anything that you're hot under the collar about that I didn't ask you about? Do you have any rants you want to, you know, pop off on anybody?
I feel like, I mean, we could go on Jeffrey Epstein for 10, 15 more hours, but I feel like I might get in trouble.
Okay. And
everyone would sort of yell at me. And the one thing I would say is, you talk to a lot of leaders. A really important thing over the next 6 weeks into the August recess is for, you know, it's really important we talk about Jeffrey Epstein. I'm not one of these people who are like, we shouldn't talk about this. We should only talk about kitchen table issues. But we have to talk about both. It is really important in the August recess that Republican House members who voted for this and lied to their constituents that it would be only minimal cuts. No, you know, they would only vote for like $300 billion or $400 billion. My favorite, Mike Lawler, who said he would absolutely not vote for more than $500 billion in Medicaid cuts and voted for $1 trillion. You know, they have to get the lesson in the recess that it is unacceptable to hurt people, take away people's health care for tax cuts for billionaires.
I agree with that. Okay, last thing. Do you ever look at J.D. Vance and think to yourself, man, in a different world, I could have been the vice president for a president that's only job was to Twitter, to quote tweet our enemies? I feel like you would have been really good at that, Neera. Like, if we had realized 10 years ago that that was the only qualification, it could have been Biden Tandon, maybe, and your job would have just been shitposting.
I would have been so good at that. Let's just be clear.
I know. So, do you look at J.D. Vance? You're like, damn. You know? No?
You know what's actually weird about, you know, like I was in government. Wasn't really shitposting.
No,
I really
you
liked
behaved
helping
while
people.
You were in government.
I mean, I was really behaving. And, you know, I liked, you know, I think a big difference between J.D. Vance and I think we're probably both pretty good at shitposting. But, like, I actually looked at government service as an opportunity to help people. And I just not tracking that as his top priority, really, at the moment. So I think there's some big differences. Although, you know, we both went to Yale Law School and we were both research assistants for this, like, very good kind of crotchety liberal. I shouldn't call him crotchety because we'll hear it. But professor. So I know a little bit about
what's
him.
What's up, professor?
Him and him that way.
What about him? The thing about his Yale, so since you have that experience together, thing that annoyed me, I have so many things that annoy me about him. I find him repulsive across every possible metric. But he tells this origin story about going to Yale Law as a country boy. And he sat at some fancy dinner that, you know, maybe that crotchety professor brought him to, I don't know. And he didn't know which fork to use and how he felt like everyone around him did. And this was really radicalizing about how the elites have a culture that they don't translate. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, we all went to college and didn't know shit. I don't know. Did you feel that way at all, Yale? Did you feel like the ostracized for the elites about the fork usage?
You know, I will say, I mean, not that I'm trying to be sympathetic to J.D. Vance, but I will say, you know, I went to public schools my whole life until I went to Yale Law School. And I loved Yale Law School. But, you know, there were a number of people there who'd, you know, gone to private school, like from the time they were two, not like five, through like Dalton, Harvard, Yale Law School. Like, it was a much more natural thing for them. I mean, the thing about J.D. Vance is that when he was at Yale Law School, you know, this is what everyone says, you know, he was Tim Miller. Like, he was David Frum. He was like positioning himself as an intellectual, moderate Republican who didn't like Obama at the edges and thought he was like, you know, had gone off, but there was like a reasonable middle in the country. And he was like, for a strong national defense, like strong, you know, I mean, none of
had
the
gay friends
like,
and all
he
that
had gay
sort of
friends.
Stuff, yeah.
Like, he's, you know, like his wife is Usha. Like, none of the hard right hate your, kill your enemies, like liberals are the monsters. I just want to eat them for breakfast. It was all like, can't we just get along in a slightly more moderate direction? So, you know, I personally, and it wasn't like he came to Yale Law School at like 19, you know, he had fully formed views by then. So like, you know, I think the tragedy.
This is good. You also, so you're saying you also felt a little socially isolated from the prep school dorks, but it didn't turn you into a fascist. So that's,
yeah, I mean, I will say, let me tell a story. So like one of my first dinners, I did go to a dinner where I turned to somebody and I was like, oh, where do you come from? And this guy turns to me and was like, when I was like, where do you come from? He decided to give me his like private school lineage. And so it literally turned to, it says like, I went to Dalton, then I went to Choate, then I went to Harvard, and now I'm at Yale Law School. And I said, I remember I said back to him, it's like, I went to public school my whole life and we're in the same place.
Yeah. You're like, I wanted to know if you were like from Kansas City.
I know, exactly. I was like, what like state are you from? And he's like giving me his whole thing. And I was
I'm stateless. I just went from prep school to boarding school to prep school, you know?
That's a little bit of the global elite right there, I have to say. Anyway, I mean, he's a lovely person, but I definitely was like, my education cost a lot less than yours, and we are in the same place. So I took it as a point of pride. I didn't actually take it as like, you know, I didn't take offense at it. I actually was like, wow, it makes me pretty cool because I didn't have all those advantages and I've shown up in the same place. But I also don't hate everybody.
Yeah, right. It's a key difference. Another key difference. Thank you so much for being in the fight. I love your tenacity. We'll be doing this again in a couple months. How's that sound?
That's great. Always fun, my friend.
All right, we'll see you soon, girl. Everybody else, we'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of the Bulwark Podcast. Peace. Yourself when you fall, you should be careful. Do you catch my drift? Cause what I really want to know is, can you catch these fists? Man down. Level up. Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.